is an overhaul of Florida's child welfare system preventing child deaths? We'll check in with the Secretary of the Florida Department of Children and Families. This is Florida Matters.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at BayCareEvents.org.
From the Donna Studio at WSF Public Media, I'm Carson Cooper. Florida is on pace to have nearly as many child deaths this year as it did before the overhaul of its child welfare system last year. In about one-fourth of those deaths, the Florida Department of Children and Families had prior contact with the families. On today's show, we're joined by DCF Secretary Mike Carroll to discuss how the department is trying to do a better job protecting children and about several recent cases that went tragically wrong. Mike Carroll, welcome.
Thank you.
When Governor Scott appointed you last year, it came at a really low point for the DCF. This came as state lawmakers were reeling from that Miami Herald investigation that found 477 kids had died since 2008 and whose families had dealings with the DCF. Now, the takeaway from that investigation, I think for many, was that the DCF just dropped the ball, didn't know what was going on. How did you react to that investigation?
I thought that the was good because it put a face on some of what we deal with. A lot of times when you see child deaths and folks read about it in the newspaper, it seems to be a number or a statistic. And the way that story was written personalized it. So I think everybody could identify with it, and it put a real face to the issue that Florida's challenged with. And we have very many families in this state, and particularly children who are asked to grow up in some very challenging circumstances. And I think we have lots to do. If you're like me, I believe that every child born in every community has an absolute right to be safe, to be healthy, to be educationally on track, and to be developmentally on track. And sadly, in this state, we have children live in homes where parents either don't have the capacity to provide the type of parenting to make sure that happens, or they just don't have the will. And because of that, we see too many tragedies in Florida.
During last year's legislative session, lawmakers passed a major overhaul of the DCF. Your agency must be a watchdog for kids and take greater care in handling neglect cases and abuse. There's more disclosure and oversight. So simple question, is it working?
Well, I think it is. But I think what that legislation represented was a real cultural change. And so we have spent much time training staff on really a new way to do investigations. Up until this point, we have been incident driven. So we went in and we really looked at a family one snapshot at a time. So if we had an investigation today and it involved a messy house, that's all we would look at, is the house messy or not, rather than looking at the whole motion picture. It's one thing to walk out and say, you know, this home might be messy today. It's another thing to walk out and understand that this is the 10th time we've been there in the past 3 years. There's something other than a messy house going on here, and we need to dig deeper to get to it if we're ever going to help this family move on. So it's moving away from an incident-based investigatory system to really a system that looks at the depth and breadth of the issues in the family. It's taken a lot. Some of our investigators who did it the old way, quite frankly, couldn't adapt and left. And some folks left because of the stress of the job. Right now, we have 82% of the folks that we have on the ground doing investigations right now in the state of Florida have been on the job 2 years or less. 70% of them have been on the job 1 year or less. And when you factor in that they have to go through a three-month pre-service training, it's really 70% of them have been on the job 9 months or less in terms of taking investigations. So we have our hands full. I think the legislation was hugely positive. I think it will move the agency forward. I think we have done a lot of the groundwork to make that happen. But in terms of it achieving outcomes, those outcomes will only be achieved with the families we deal with now going forward, can't go back and address what was already done. And that's what we see in a lot of these cases that come back. They have histories over years that we can't go back and change what our interactions were back then.
Back in January, a shocking case in the Bay Area was the murder of 5-year-old Phoebe Johnchuck at the hands of her father, allegedly, who threw her off a bridge near the Skyway. The DCF found that it did not properly respond to calls to its hotline. I believe you spoke out about that in the hours after that. And in the hours before the murder, though, something happened that called into question her father's mental stability and the safety of his daughter. His lawyer, Johnchuck, his lawyer says he called your abuse hotline hours before the murder, warning that he could harm his daughter. His daughter's life was in danger, but nothing happened.
It was actually a female attorney who called us, but it was the dad's attorney. And you're right. And she called us after she called law enforcement, which was, in this case, the proper thing to do. Law enforcement was dispatched, and they had two deputies. Both were CIT trained, and by that they were trained to assess a person for their mental health stability, and they had the power to Baker Act that person if that person was deemed to be a threat to themselves or others. And so that assessment was performed. When they called, when the lawyer subsequently called the hotline, she reported to us that she felt the child was unsafe. But she also reported to us that the assessment had already been done by law enforcement, and law enforcement had determined he did not meet the criteria and did not appear to be a threat, which really points to, and I say all the time that our work is complex, it really does point to the complexity of it. Looking back now, there's no doubt that this gentleman was having an acute mental health crisis. But different folks who ran into him at different intervals during the day had different takeaways. Nonetheless, that call that was made to the hotline, and I listened to that call myself, that call should have been taken, and we should have dispatched an investigator. It's unclear if the investigator would have made contact with Mr. Johnchuck that day because he was mobile. Law enforcement caught up to him at a church that he had visited a couple of times during the day. And then he was subsequently mobile in the vehicle again. So I don't know whether the actual protective investigators would have made contact with him or not. That call wasn't accepted by the hotline worker because it didn't meet the protocols that we had. Now, when I listen to it, as a layperson, I say I take that call 100 times out of 100. But our folks who work in the hotline have what's called an allegation matrix, which takes the Florida statute, because we can only engage in those cases that statute allows us to engage in. And it didn't fit nicely into one of the allegation matrix squares, which is one of the reasons why we made an immediate change at the hotline and said anytime somebody calls and says that a parent may be having a mental health crisis, whether you can regardless whatever information you have, we're going to dispatch somebody immediately to that.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And you've said that dealing with a mentally ill parent can be really, really difficult. Agreed. And I don't know anything about these matrices, but when a call comes in like that, it seems pretty clear what the next step should be.
Oh, absolutely. And I can tell you that we've received 94 calls since that day, alleging that somebody is in mental health crisis, and we've responded to all 94. And I'm happy to say in a couple of them, I believe that we did save children, because we had some cases where we had women, moms, who were suffering from postpartum depression, mm-hmm. And were threatening suicide. And, you know, we see too many horror stories that come from that. But we believe that the change we made at the hotline has actually been beneficial.
Now, Mike Carroll, as you and I sit here right now, is it your opinion that today most of your workers have the skill set to do their job?
I think that all of the workers we have the educational background to do their job. I think that some of them are very much better at it than others. We're no different than any other field or industry you go to. And I don't care what line of business you're in. When you look at your employee base, you have a bell curve. And we have some folks that are outstanding at what they do. We have most of the folks that show up and do a good job and do exactly what we want. And we have a fair number of folks who struggle at what they do and, quite frankly, don't do the job very well. And we work as hard as we can to provide those folks with additional support in decision-making. We try and provide those folks with additional training. And if that doesn't work, we work hard to make sure that we find those folks other things to do. Because the unfortunate thing in our business is even though we have a bell curve, for those folks who don't perform, the consequences of not performing to some of these kids can be tragic. And what I say to our workers all the time is we are some kids' last best hope. When you walk through their door, you are literally their last best hope, sometimes to live. But most of the time, you're their last best hope to have a healthy, normal childhood where they can come out the other end and be reasonably well-adjusted when they're teenagers and beyond. And so we need to take that charge very seriously. You need the right types of folks doing it with the right type of education, the right type of training, the right type of support. And we can't always tell that from what your educational degree is. So we have to constantly be vigilant with our work staff in terms of who's doing what to make sure that we only retain the best folks.
Coming up.
Why on earth do we have so many parents in this state that kill their children? Because until we begin understanding what's driving that issue, all we're doing in the department is providing Band-Aids. We're responding and we're trying to keep kids safe, but we can't remove every child.
We'll continue our conversation with Mike Carroll, the Secretary of the Florida Department of Children and Families. I'm Carson Cooper. This is Florida Matters. I'm Carson Cooper. This is Florida Matters. And now more of our conversation with Mike Carroll, the Secretary of the Florida Department of Children and Families. Now, DCF works with local child protection agencies. Is that a good relationship around the state? And I bring that up because of some recent cases in Manatee County and in Northport in Charlotte County, the deaths of two children there. How does DCF work with local agencies?
I think the misnomer for a lot of folks is whenever you see the press or folks talk about child welfare, it's easy to say DCF. The fact of the matter is child welfare is really a big network of folks, public and private, that work together to keep kids safe. Tampa Bay is unique from any other area because in Tampa Bay, you probably have the most bifurcated system of care in the country. So it's really this big safety net. And the key is to make sure that they're all talking to each other and sharing information, rowing in the same direction. When they're not is when we run into problems.
It's a big safety net, but there are a lot of moving parts here. I bring up the death of 11-year-old Janiah Thomas in Manatee County. That was fairly recently. She'd been missing for a year. Court papers revealed that Manatee Children's Services had visited the Thomas home multiple times from 2004 to 2015, producing 26 pages of reports, extensive evidence of ongoing abuse. And in spite of that, the kids stayed in the home, and the report concluded that the risk to the children was low. Now, first of all, is that the version you heard?
That's not the exact version that I know. In fact, the last time the case was closed out in 2014, it was closed out with the risk still being high, which is concerning. We do have had a history, and that is one of the counties where we have the sheriff feet on the ground doing the actual investigatory work. And I think it's really points to how complex this work can be sometimes because and when I say the sheriff was doing the work, a lot of times when I say that, folks will say, well, you're trying to deflect blame. I'm not trying to deflect blame. I'm just trying to point out that there are no magic bullets to this work. You can change who signs the check. You can change what uniform folks work. But in the end, this is a people helping people business. I got people walking through front doors and into living rooms all around this state every day, and they're asked to make split-second life, sometimes life-altering decisions for families. Many, many times we get it right. Sometimes we get it wrong. In this case represents the exact type of case that led to some of the child reforms you saw in the statute last year, where you had an extended history, and if you look at each one of those investigations, they looked at it very much in an incident-driven way, where they only looked at the circumstance that brought them into that case on that day. And to me, that's a mistake. That's a mistake that we've been making in this system for a long time. We need to look at the whole depth and breadth of the case. Mm-hmm. By the time you got to the end of the case, because when you look at this case and you say there's 11 or 10 years worth of investigatory reports, or I think there was 11 altogether reports, when you look at these different reports, if you start at the first one and you look at it through the eyes of the investigator, it's one thing. And then you go two and three. To me, where we have to get better is by the time you get to 11, if you aren't looking at all of these in conjunction and understanding that this isn't getting better and that these kids have been living in an environment that at minimum is dysfunctional and has not facilitated a positive environment for them educationally, developmentally, for their personal self-esteem, their safety, their health, then we need to make decisions based on that bigger motion picture.
And I know you at DCF hear this all the time. It's a public perception thing. When people hear things like that, and the John Chuck lawyer calling with a warning hours before a murder happens, people wonder, how clear does it have to be that a kid is in danger and something has to happen?
If you're asking what the criteria is for you...
We're hearing all about the criteria, but yeah. I mean, there's a human being observing
absolutely.
This, and an action has to happen.
Well, one of the things I asked my... We can't possibly put in pen and paper what all of the criteria must be, and I can't script out for an investigator everything. Part of what we tell folks and what we're trying to get folks to internalize is that we have a sacred mission to protect vulnerable kids, and we ought to be doing it the same way we would for our own kids. So if you walk into a home and there is something askew where you would feel uncomfortable leaving your own child there, then you need to ask more questions. And if you feel uncomfortable or you think you need assistance in assessing what might really be underlying the issue, then bump it up to leadership. And so that's the culture that we're trying to build. I will tell you, in real time, these cases, when you have a child death case and you're looking back, it is easy to put the pieces in place because you have the power of looking back retrospectively. When you're in it and you have 15 other cases, investigators don't always make the right decision. They don't always bump some things up. Because they see what they see every day, they sometimes become immune to it, which is some of what we have to guard against. I can tell you that what they see and what they do every day, I consider them to be heroes. I have an opposite view, because if there weren't people like the investigators in Manatee County, like the investigators we have all over the state doing the work they're doing, this state would be a different place, and it wouldn't be for the better. So I agree with you that we make mistakes, and we have cases that I would give anything to go back and make different decisions in those cases to get different outcomes. But if there weren't folks doing this work every day, this situation would be a lot worse. So I think they do a lot more good than they do wrong. But I got to tell you, some of these issues go beyond what the department can do. There's this unfair expectation placed on the department that we can fix all the ills of society. We can't. Most of the families we deal with, including the case that you're citing, have had these issues are generational. They extend up the family. They extend across family lines. If you go and look at the support networks in place, the friends and associates, very often they have some of the same issues. It becomes difficult. Somebody said, well, pull a kid out and place him with grandma. In some cases, grandma has the same extended history that mom has, and it becomes very difficult. Often these cases involve substance abuse, mental health issues, domestic violence. Often we're dealing with folks who have their education is not as much as you see in other more successful homes. Often poverty plays a role in it. So these are all society issues that is going to take a concerted society effort to move the needle forward, even with us being the last best hope. I got to tell you, the kids most at risk in this state are the youngest kids, 0 to 3. And we've moved our focus to really begin to drill in on that population. And if we have young moms or young parents that show up that have a behavioral health issue, a substance abuse issue, have no experience parenting a child, then those kids are at risk. And we have to find a way to intervene in those families earlier. And we have to find a way to make sure that the acuity of our services, the intensity of our services, matches what issues these folks come in with. To think that I'm going to deal with a 20-year-old parent who themselves was a victim of abuse and neglect, who now has a substance abuse issue, who now has a paramour who is violent, who himself has a drug issue. And to think that we're going to take these and deal with these families and send them to a class and that's going to fix it, it's unrealistic. There are some deep-rooted, deep-seated issues that are driving this. And what I hope is, and I don't mind the scrutiny because I think the department needs to be open to the scrutiny. If we screwed up, we ought to be the first ones out there saying what we did and how we're going to fix it. But we've got to get the conversation to a place where we start asking, why do we have so many parents in this state who do not have the capacity to parent for their kids? And why on earth do we have so many parents in this state that kill their children? Because until we begin understanding what's driving that issue, all we're doing in the department is providing Band-Aids. We're responding, and we're trying to keep kids safe. But we can't remove every child. You know, as a result of the legislation that passed last year, our removal rates are up. We got a significant increase in our budget last year because our removal – and when I say removal rates, I mean we're taking more kids out of their homes and placing them in foster or adoptive homes.
Is Florida an outlier among the states as far as these types of cases? Parents who kill their kids, as you pointed out.
That's difficult to say. Another frustration of mine in child welfare is nothing's done the same around the country. So Florida is very progressive in the way we track child fatalities. So, for instance, if you looked at the child fatality website in Florida, we're one of the only states. In fact, we've had several states come to us trying to emulate our child fatality website in their state to make it very public.
Mm-hmm.
But it's clearly, if you look at a child fatality website, it clearly points to child fatalities as being a public health issue. In the state of Florida, we get about 450 reports called into the hotline every year that involve a child fatality. 450. To me, that's an outrageous number. But when you look at it more deeply, the leading cause of death is unsafe sleep, where there was not an intentional act. It was either a parent co-slept with a baby or they were put in an unsafe crib or they were put on a couch. There are times when folks co-sleep with a child and they're on substances. You know, to me, that's neglectful. To me, that should be a crime. That's no different to me than driving under the influence. Second leading cause of death in Florida is child drowning. Some of that is directly associated with minimal parent oversight and supervision. And the third leading cause of death for children called into the hotline is SIDS, SUIDS, or some other natural cause of death. I say that because if you go and you compare our child deaths or our child fatality numbers with other states, most states don't report those type deaths to their hotline. There has to be abuse and neglect expected. And so a lot of times when other states report, they only report out on inflicted trauma deaths.
So it is hard to tell. But as you pointed out, it's one is too many.
It's one is too many. 450 to me is an absolute red flag for this state that we have a public health issue around children and child deaths in this state.
Governor Scott recently announced a proposal for an additional $22.9 million for DCF, which would allow community-based agencies to hire more case managers. Is that one of the weaker links in the system right now?
Well, I don't think it's a weaker link. I think as the legislation passed and the legislature made it clear that child safety should be our number one priority, you've seen a change in behavior in terms of how our investigations are handled. We are removing more kids from their homes for reasons that we may not have removed in the past. Because of that, we have as many kids in care now as we did in 2008. It's a seven-year high in terms of the numbers of kids that we have in care. And when we serve kids in care, it's important. You know, folks think that our job ends when we remove a child from a home because we kept them safe. To me, our job is not just keeping a child safe from physical abuse and harm. I think every child is special, and there's a light within each child. And if you're a parent, you'll know what I'm talking about. You know, you drop your child off at daycare, at least I did when my child was young, and the first couple of times they literally had to pry him off my leg because he didn't want to go. But when you go to pick up your child in a playground or at school or at a daycare, when they see you, and no matter how far away you are, they drop everything, their eyes light up, and they run towards you. As a parent, there's no better feeling. And to me, that's what makes every child special. It's that light inside them. The department's charge is not just to keep kids alive. It's not just to keep kids safe from physical abuse or sexual abuse. It's to keeping that light that burns within every child burning brightly. And so when we remove a child, I think about my own child because I adopted my child through the child welfare system. And I can't imagine – he was such a shy kid. He's not anymore. But he was such a shy kid. And I can't imagine if that – my son had been removed and then placed at different foster homes with folks he didn't know. And I wonder if we did that, if that light inside him would be burning as bright as it is now, if he'd be the same person, the same personality. And I don't think so. And we see it with some of the kids that we bring in care. They change because the light dims. The first thing we need is we need enough case managers so that we can effectively manage that child while they're in care, because we have to make sure that they're able to receive the services they need to cope with the trauma that they've experienced.
Mike Carroll, Secretary of the Florida Department of Children and Families, it's always good to see you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
And that's it for today's show. Florida Matters is produced by Lottie Watts, our engineer, Craig George. Florida Matters is a production of WUSF Public Media. I'm Kirsten Cooper. Thanks for listening.